It's the NPR News Update. Hi, I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for finding Minnesota's news on your schedule for this Wednesday, February 27th. Coming up, detailed stories about a possible frac sand mining moratorium, the overpumping of Minnesota waters, why Minnesota schools don't want the state to pay them back just yet, and Madeline Albright visits the NPR studios. First, Best Buy is cutting 400 jobs, primarily at its Richfield headquarters, and it says further cost cutting is coming. Martin Moylan reports.
The consumer electronics retailer says the move is only the first phase of a $725 million belt-tightening program announced last fall. The company says the job cuts won't involve store closings or store sales staff, but will otherwise be spread throughout the company. The firm has some 8,000 employees in Minnesota. As of last June, 5,000 were at its headquarters. Edward Jones retail analyst Brian Yarbrough says CEO Hubert Joly has much more to do to make the retailer leaner.
I'm not saying there's going to be additional layoffs. There always could be, but I definitely think he's looking at every cost line with a keen eye and looking for ways to make additional cuts and savings.
Best Buy reports its holiday earnings Friday. Analysts are eager to see whether better-than-expected sales came at the expense of drastic cuts to prices and profits.
That's NPR business reporter Martin Moylan. DFL Governor Mark Dayton's tax overhaul plan gets an extensive public airing tonight. The House Tax Committee has scheduled the meeting to allow supporters and opponents a chance to weigh in. Dayton's proposal includes an income tax increase on top earners, a sales tax expansion under a lower rate, and property tax refunds for homeowners. DFL Representative Ann Lancheski of Bloomington, the committee chair, says she's hoping to hear from what she calls real Minnesotans.
Just let us know what you like and what you don't like. And, you know, we have a lot of people at the Capitol who get paid to be here, and we're hoping to hear from some folks who don't get paid to be here and just are kind of watching everything unfold, and we want to hear what they're thinking about the governor's proposal.
Republicans have criticized the Dayton plan for a month. They claim many of the proposed tax changes would hurt businesses. A Senate committee has approved a one-year moratorium on new frac sand mining. The legislation also requires the state to do an in-depth environmental review on how silica sand mining could impact health and the environment. Elizabeth Dunbar says many Minnesota legislators want to slow down the process of approving new mines.
The debate at the Capitol has pitted those seeking the jobs and money that would come with new silica sand mines against the people who would live near those operations. Jason George is with a union representing heavy equipment operators in Minnesota. He told lawmakers that the busy silica sand mining operations in Wisconsin are expected to create more than 2,500 jobs.
How many more jobs in Wisconsin are going to be created before we let our people here compete? I just don't believe this is the best way to go forward in the interest of job creation.
I don't have to go very far. I don't have to leave the state to see what's happened in Wisconsin. I can see it from not far from my house.
DFL Senator Matt Schmidt is from Red Wing, and the debate over silica sand mining has been contentious there. He wants to make sure Minnesota mines its sand responsibly.
And if there's a long-term demand for this sand, as industry has told us there is, there will be plenty of opportunities for jobs in the future.
Schmidt sponsors a bill that calls for a one-year moratorium on new mining. He says that would give the state enough time to complete an in-depth environmental review of the industry. Industry officials say state agencies are already studying the issue. Peter Larson lobbies for silica sand mine operators. Larson says mining companies support state standards.
Now, we believe a lot of those state standards exist. We can't start construction without an air permit from the MPCA. We support stringent environmental review. We do it. Our projects are subject to it. We support it.
Bobby King of the Land Stewardship Project, which supports the moratorium, compared sand mining to large feedlots in arguing for state regulation. He said the standards came too late in that case.
So communities suffered for years before we were able to get enough people back to the legislature to create a strong MPCA permit. So I know there will be permits created for this industry eventually. It's just a matter, do we do it now before the harm is done, or are we going to do it later after the harm is done?
The bill also places a tax on silica sand production. Local government officials and residents in southeastern Minnesota are concerned about exposure to silica dust, possible water pollution, and truck traffic that could damage roads. Supporters say a tax could help pay for repairs. Marie Kaveski of Winona says she's concerned about diesel exhaust from trucks hauling the sand and she presented lawmakers with some calculations.
Just one of the barge operations in the city has been permitted for 48 barges a month. It takes 60 truckloads to fill one barge. So if you do the frac sand truck math and work it out, how many truck trips? It's 5,760 truck trips a month. Divide by 30, you have 192 truck trips a day.
Republican Senator Julie Rosen of Fairmont says she considers silica sand mining part of agriculture, an economic force in the state.
This is agriculture. People live in agricultural land. They have to expect the smells and the dust and the inconveniences and their roads beat up because that is what happens. Mr. Chair.
The audience became quiet at the tap of the gavel, but began applauding after the bill was approved. The bill has a long journey ahead, including several committee stops and winning over members of the House. A sand mining regulation bill in that body does not contain a moratorium or a production tax.
Elizabeth Dunbar there, now Mark Stile. DNR records show that scores of water permit holders in Minnesota are illegally using billions of gallons more water than they're supposed to, at a time when drought threatens state water supplies. But Mark reports they face few consequences for these misdemeanor violations.
The violations come from nearly every category of water user: cities, crop irrigators, power companies, private businesses, golf courses, schools, government agencies, even a church. All have a state permit which lets them take a set amount of water each year from underground wells, rivers, lakes, and wetlands. But many aren't obeying the terms of their permit. Dale Holmuth is the DNR's head of water permit regulation.
There's no doubt that a lot of them are appropriating more water than they're currently authorized.
The DNR is supposed to enforce the permits, but Holmuth says stopping the excessive pumping is not a high priority. He says the DNR's main objectives include processing new water permits.
The number of new permit applications we're dealing with are at record levels the last couple years. Every one of those is complicated, controversial, takes a lot of staff time, and we have the same staffing levels we've had for 20 years dealing on these water appropriation permits.
Holmuth says another top priority is finding and dealing with illegal, non-permitted wells. But State House member Gene Wagenius, who chairs the Environment, Natural Resources, and Agriculture Finance Committee, disagrees with that policy. Wagenius says drought is stretching the state's water resources. Speaking in her noisy state capitol office, she says the DNR should give overpumping equal priority to processing new permits and finding illegal pumping.
DNR needs to do all three.
But so far, that hasn't happened. The DNR's water permit data shows the vast majority of the state's more than 7,000 permit holders stay well under their maximum allotment, but others seem to ignore it. At the Gerdau Ameristeel plant here in Duluth, the company has taken as much as five times its permit limit in recent years from Lake Superior. In central Minnesota, one plant business, Green Lake Nursery, overpumped from the Redwood River practically every year for two decades. One year it used more than 50 times its limit. The Twin Cities suburb of Ramsey consistently exceeds one of its permits, some years using as much as five times the amount allowed. NPR contacted several permit violators. None of them remembered any letter, phone call, email, or personal visit from the DNR, alerting them that they were taking more water than their permit allowed. None would agree to be recorded for broadcast, but these permit overpumpers rarely face any penalties, even though the DNR is authorized to step in. The agency's Dale Holmuth says that's because he doesn't have enough staff to identify violators.
We're struggling with a 20-30-year-old database system. We still get paper that we have to mail out and get back from over 7,000 appropriators and then manually enter all this data into this database.
But NPR was able to identify serial violators with just a couple hours of work and a spreadsheet program. Minnesota law says exceeding the permitted water limit is a misdemeanor, but the DNR's HOMA says no one's ever been charged.
Not to my knowledge.
He says that's because it costs too much to prosecute. Pat Sweeney is the research and communications director for the Freshwater Society, a Twin Cities-based group that works to protect water resources. Sweeney says the DNR should at least contact anyone who exceeds their pumping limit to call it to their attention.
If the DNR invested more time and energy and effort, I think they could clear up some of these problems.
Overpumping can cause real problems. In at least one case in recent years, overpumping by a neighbor contributed to a rural well going dry. Last year, with the drought impact growing, well owners filed nearly a dozen more so-called well interference complaints. The DNR has not yet determined if excessive pumping played a role in any of those well disruptions. But a dry well is a big problem. Southwest Minnesota resident Wade Anderson, who lives near Worthington, slides the concrete cover off his backyard well, his only source of water. He's one of many rural residents in the state who've seen the drought shrink the size of the underground aquifer they depend on. Anderson has run out of water at times.
With a family of five, it's tough to have to worry about getting water. There's just not a lot of good options out there.
There's no indication anything beyond the drought has hurt Anderson's water supply, but State House member Gene Wagenia says the drought is a good reason why the DNR should more actively enforce water permit limits.
You want to make sure that someone doesn't use more than their fair share, because if they use more than their fair share, then the neighbor may have to dig a new well, and new wells and deeper wells are very expensive.
Overpumping could also accelerate water depletion in underground supplies of water called aquifers. A recent U.S. Geological Survey study said falling aquifer supplies likely caused declining water levels in White Bear Lake. Metropolitan Council Water Supply Planning Manager Ali Al-Hassan says heavy demand has dramatically dropped water levels in that major aquifer under the Twin Cities by about 40 feet in the last 35 years in some locations.
We are starting seeing trends that are not sustainable. And if we continue business as usual, pumping groundwater to meet our growth in the future, we'll start seeing even further adverse impact into our aquifers.
But if the DNR looks the other way on overpumping, the agency is focused on at least one part of the water permit program, collecting the fee water permit holders owe the state. With few exceptions, they pay for the water they pump. The agency collects about $4 million a year from those fees. And when permit holders exceed their limit, the DNR gets more money. That's because the overpumper pays for those extra gallons. The DNR's Dale Homas says collecting the money is a priority.
As long as they pay, we're happy.
Among the overpumpers NPR contacted, a clear pattern emerged. While it's not a scientific sample, most permit violations appear to be based on a misunderstanding of permit requirements. The Gerdau Ameristeel plant in Duluth fits that pattern. The company regularly reports withdrawing more water from Lake Superior than its permit allows. Gerdau officials would not do a recorded interview, but in an email they said the company returns nearly all the water it takes from Superior back to the lake. So to calculate permit usage, they subtract the gallons of returned water from what they pump. The DNR's Dale Homath says that's not the right way to do it.
They only think they need a permit for how much they actually consume, not how much they're pumping out of the lake, which is wrong.
DNR officials predict that better enforcement of water permit pumping levels will come with a new permit monitoring system slated to be operational later this year. When the new system is up and running and tracking over pumpers, it should flag the DNR itself. The agency's own data shows the DNR holds 65 water permits and has overpumped half a dozen of them, some in multiple years.
Mark Stile on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule.
As lawmakers put together a state budget for the next 2 years, some people might find it odd that school leaders in Minnesota seem to be in no hurry to get a big chunk of money they're owed from the state. Lawmakers delayed payments to schools in recent years to balance the state budget. It's called the school shift, and it amounts to more than $1 billion. There are bipartisan efforts this year at the state capitol to pay back the shift immediately, despite how school officials feel. Here's Tim Post.
When you lend money to someone, usually you want it paid back as soon as possible. For example, let's say I borrow some money from my colleague Chris Roberts here in the NPR newsroom. Hi, Chris. I was wondering if I could borrow 50 cents. I just want to buy some gum.
Oh, sure, sure. If I have it, I might have to go to the cash machine. Oh, no, I do. I do. Here it is. 50 cents.
Thanks. A few weeks pass by, and I go back to Chris Roberts' desk. Hey, Chris, here's the 50 cents I owe you.
Oh, that's okay. You don't have to pay me back now.
Well, I'm ready to pay you back. I want to pay you back, and I have the money. It's right here.
No, that's all right. Just pay me back later. It's fine.
Okay. Well, this is sort of weird.
No, I'm fine for now. Just pay me back sometime down the road.
Okay. And scene. That's an oversimplified version of what's taking place at the Capitol, as lawmakers offer to pay back the money they borrowed from schools, and school leaders are politely declining. In recent years, as a way to balance the state budget, lawmakers delayed funding to schools. At one point, schools received about 60% of their funding at the beginning of the school year, and the final 40% came at the end of the year. It's left Minnesota schools with a $1.1 billion IOU from the state. But school leaders say they have reasons why they don't want the money paid back right away. Chris Richardson, the superintendent in Northfield, says within a few years that money is scheduled to be paid back anyway. So for now, he and other school leaders would rather the state use its money to provide new funding for schools, money that would likely continue into the future.
If all the money is taken to pay the shift back in one lump sum, there will be no dollars left over to fund any increases in state aid.
When lawmakers delayed state funding to fix the budget, some schools had to borrow money to make ends meet. Richardson claims that isn't much of a problem, however, since the rate for schools to borrow operating funds is less than 0.5%. As much as delaying payback may make perfect sense to schools, it's not something that's registered with those at the legislature working on bipartisan efforts to pay schools the money they're owed. Representative Paul Marquardt is a DFLer from Dilworth who chairs the House Education Finance Committee. Marquardt touts a DFL effort to pay back about half of what schools are owed and increase their per-pupil funding.
I think we can both pay back the shift and also invest in children and schools.
Meanwhile, Republican Representative Kelby Woodard from Belle Plaine has proposed legislation to pay back the entire $1.1 billion owed to schools, but leaves out the increase in funding. Paying back schools is something Woodard thinks needs to be done before the state offers schools any increase in funding.
My take is we need to take care of our current obligations, and then we can talk about what those future promises are.
The desire to repay schools sooner rather than later may be a byproduct of last fall's election, when both parties decried the budget balancing tactics that led to the debt and promised to be more fiscally responsible. To that end, Woodard is also pushing legislation that would make it harder for lawmakers to shift school payments in the future. Governor Mark Dayton's budget proposal this session offers $344 million in new funding to schools, and the plan pays back that money owed to schools by 2017. But how much the state actually owes could change, depending on a new state budget forecast that comes out Thursday. If there's any extra revenue coming into state coffers, by law it goes directly to schools, to chip away at the money they're owed from the state.
Tim Post on the NPR News Update. For the rest of the podcast, today on the Daily Circuit, Carrie Miller talked with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright.
I was in Colorado last spring and happened to wander into the Denver Museum of Art. And there, among the Indian artifacts and the Georgia O'Keeffes, glittered gold and jeweled pins that tell the story of Secretary Albright's adventures on the world stage. She served as Secretary of State from 1997 to 2001 during the Clinton presidency. She was also UN ambassador. Her newest book, now out in paperback, is titled Prague Winter. And she joins us this morning from Palm Beach, Florida. Secretary, welcome. It is such a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, great to be with you. I'm down here on the book tour, and so I'm delighted to have a chance to talk with you.
Do you mind if we talk about the pins?
No, fine.
Okay, good. Because they are surprisingly revealing. I mean, this exhibit tells us so much more about your life and what was going on behind the scenes than I ever expected. Are they back with you, or are they still traveling the world?
No, they're actually close to you. They're in Grand Rapids, Michigan at the Gerald Ford Library.
There are 200 or so of them?
They are, about. And the thing that's fun about them is that they all have foreign policy stories. They're pretty, but the bottom line is I see them as kind of an educational tool in terms of telling people about some foreign policy things that I was involved in and making foreign policy less foreign.
Well, indeed. I mean, it is interesting to know how you were thinking and what you were thinking about as you were going into a meeting, let's say with Vladimir Putin, and you would put on a pin that was a three monkey pin, blazing there to send him a message loud and clear. And maybe you never had to say what you were thinking the pin said at all.
Well, I tell you, that was one of the times I probably went too far in my pin choice, because these were the hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil monkeys. And we were going to the summit meeting with the Russians, President Clinton and I, and President Putin turns to President Clinton and says, "We always watch to see what pin Secretary Albright wears. Why are you wearing those monkeys?" And I said, "Because of your Chechnya policy," and it made him furious. And President Clinton looked at me like, "Have you lost your mind? You are supposed to be the top diplomat, not the troublemaker." So, but mostly it was fun in terms of there was another occasion with the Russians that really was fun. Was the Russians had been bugging the State Department, and there was a man sitting outside listening to what we were doing. And when we found out, we obviously went to Moscow and complained. But then the next time I met with the Russian foreign minister, I wore this huge bug, and he knew exactly what was going on.
As the story of the pins began to spread, would you find that world leaders were looking to how you were thinking of them on your shoulder with your jewelry?
Well, I think they did. I mean, what happened, again, a Russian story, was that I was negotiating the anti-ballistic missile treaty with the Russian foreign minister, and I had on a pin that actually is an arrow but looks like a missile. And he said, "So is that one of your interceptors?" And I said, "Yes, and we make them small, and it's time for you to negotiate."
While we're talking about Russia, I want to talk about something that you wrote towards the end of your book. You said that Russian authorities are reviving the idea of positive history, a retelling that says that Stalin won World War II while the Americans and the British were trying to negotiate with Hitler. It is clear at the end of this book you feel very strongly about making sure that that history is told correctly. Why?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I think the thing, and it's very interesting in terms of how various decisions affect the psyche of a nation. So very briefly, what had happened when the Munich Agreement was signed in the fall of 1938, the British and French had made a deal over the heads of Czechoslovaks with the Germans and Italians and sold the country down the river. The French had a treaty with the Czechoslovakia saying that if there was aggression, they would come in and help. So when the Nazis marched in March, people expected something to happen. They didn't do anything. The Soviets had said they also, if the French went in, they would, in fact, also come and help. Since the French didn't, the Soviets had an excuse. And so what happened was that the psyche of the Czechs, Czechoslovaks, was that the West had let them down and the Soviet Union hadn't. And that is part of the history that needs to be understood. And then the Soviet Union, quote, liberated Czechoslovakia and kept it under communism for 50 years. Mm-hmm. So I do think it's important for people to understand that during the war, the Soviet Union was our ally, but some of the things that Stalin had done pre-war and post-war were certainly not something that helped the democratic evolution of any country.
And do you find that Vladimir Putin is one of those that tries to further this goal of positive history, the rewriting of history?
No question. But let me just say this. I do think that one needs to honor what the Russian soldiers did during World War II. They lost an incredible number of people. And they really, when that front was opened up, it changed a great deal about World War II. And I think that that needs to be recognized. But what I'm troubled by is Vladimir Putin, as he is trying to make clear that there is some kind of Russian identity, mm-hmm. is, I think, pulling on the wrong lessons in many ways of some of the brutality and the repression. And I think it's the wrong way to go. But the Russians have lost their identity since the end of the Cold War, and Putin is pulling on every nationalist string he can to give himself power and also to show Russia's a role in the world, which is certainly not the same as it used to be.
So as you watch him try to recreate that identity, what does that identity look like?
Well, I think it's fairly, aggressive in many ways, of trying to show that the Russians continue to have power it reverts back some to the czars, but also to Stalin in some ways, and trying to figure out how they assert their role. And one of the very visible points at this moment is what it is they are not doing as far as Syria is concerned. They are pushing, they're not helping at all in terms of getting Assad out, and are in fact in many ways coming at things from an opposite point of view that the United States and the Western Europe is interested in.
Is exactly something that I wanted to ask you about. Is Russia's role in the Syrian conflict more about their relationship with the United States than anything that's really happening on the ground in Syria?
I think it's a combination of things. I do think Russia used to have a great deal of influence in the Middle East in a number of different ways. And they do, in fact, have a port in Syria. They have been, they were original supporters of Assad, and they want to reestablish that role. But partially it's also to show again that they are an equal power with the United States. And what we'll have to see, Secretary Kerry is negotiating now with Foreign Minister Lavrov, and I'm sure that those are very interesting discussions in terms of how we affect each other, what is our relationship with each other, and that Russia needs, I think from the Russian perspective, they want to make clear that they have to be taken seriously, that they are not a third-rate power, but that they are still the power that they used to be.
You know, that strikes me as one of the most difficult things that a Secretary of State would have to do, knowing the reality of where, at least from, I guess, the United States point of view, of where Russia fits into this, but making sure that you are not too dismissive and ignoring the face-saving that Russia needs to play well in the international community. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And it's very difficult. Let me tell you, I think one of the interesting parts that we were faced with during the Clinton administration, the Soviet Union had disintegrated and the empire, so to speak, had disintegrated. And it was very important to treat the Russians with respect, which we tried to do.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't get it that way. They were very irritated when we expanded NATO, even though we had made very clear that they were welcome in NATO. That was one of the things we were saying at the time. You did have to be a democratic government to be part of NATO, but we never intended to kind of shut them out. And they took everything wrong, if I might put it that way, and felt that we weren't respecting them enough, and I think they feel that way now. So the question is, how do you give them respect, even though they are not behaving in a way that earns it, and at the same time also able to put ourselves in their shoes and then get them to go along with us on what we think is a very important foreign policy issue?
Well, and then the consequences are not just that Russia's upset and our relationship isn't good with them. It's all the other ways that they can affect relationships throughout the international community, right?
Right. I mean, they, first, for instance, they are permanent members of the Security Council. Their behavior also has something to do with what, or a lot to do with what we're doing in Iran on sanctions, multilateral sanctions. Same is true now vis-a-vis North Korea. I mean, they play a role as there's an attempt to get sanctions resolutions against North Korea for their nuclear test and missile deployments. And so they do continue to play a role, and I think it's important for us to deal with them and at the same time make clear that in some ways they're on the wrong track.
Yeah, one of the things that you've written about in the book and that I wanted to talk to you about is the complications of moral choices. And you bring up the sanctions. The United States knows that when you impose sanctions on countries that are bad actors, the people that you're really hurting are probably the average Iranians, North Koreans, along with trying to affect the government of those countries. I'm interested in what that conversation sounds like between a Secretary of State and a president as you're thinking about sanctions and who is actually going to bear the deepest burden of those sanctions.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I teach at Georgetown, and I talk about the national security toolbox. What are the things that any country has in order to affect another country's behavior? And there's diplomacy, bilateral and multilateral, and there's the use of force and the threat of force. And in the middle of that choice are the economic tools, sanctions. And so in many ways, it's kind of a tool that you think is easy to pick up. We learned a lot about sanctions. When President Clinton came into office, the Gulf War had just ended, and the ceasefire had been translated into a series of sanctions against Iraq. And they were full sanctions, except for the fact that food and medicine was allowed in, because you don't want to hurt the people. But full sanctions are, in some ways, kind of a blunt instrument. So we learned a lot about smart sanctions, we called them. We first started using them against Milosevic in the Balkans. And so it's a way to try not to hurt all the people, but to affect specifically the decision makers and their cronies. But it's a tough instrument, and yet it is one that is very often used in foreign policy, because it's a way to try to change the behavior of the government. But it is hard.
I mean, you think about a delicate situation in a country like Iran, where it's the leadership that is so difficult to deal with the United States. And you hear, and I'm sure you know, that the average Iranian seems to be friendly towards Americans, supportive of the idea of what we're trying to do in the United States. What you don't want to do is turn that public opinion away from the United States, right? That could be a very valuable tool at some point in the future.
It could. And the bottom line is that often the local population actually approves of the sanctions. This is a different issue, but what I found interesting, the time that multilateral sanctions really worked was to end apartheid in South Africa.
Huh.
And Nelson Mandela was for sanctions. And the people understood it, and it really did make a difference. Another place where sanctions made a difference was in Burma. Aung San Suu Kyi was for sanctions. And as the government changed there, the United States has removed the sanctions, suspended the sanctions. So it's actually a useful tool if it's used properly. And if you think about what the tools are in order to change behavior, there are not a lot of them. And so I think we have learned much more about how to make the sanctions more surgical than like a meat cleaver.
Carrie Miller and Madeline Albright from today's Daily Circuit program. You heard it right here on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for joining me. I'll be back with Thursday's news, same place, same time tomorrow.